Good morning, everybody. Welcome to our wonderful series on Tanakh. And it gives me great pleasure today to introduce Rabbi Dr. Moshe Sokolow. Rabbi Sokolow is the Associate Dean and holds the Fania Gottesfeld Heller Chair of Jewish Education at the Israeli Graduate School of Jewish Education at Yeshiva University. He's the author of Chatzi Nechama, Studies in the Weekly Parsha, based on the lessons of Nechama Leibowitz, Tanakh, an Owner's Manual, Reading the Rav, Exploring Religious Themes in the Writings of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, and a number of volumes that are just about to be published. It's a great pleasure for me personally and for all of us today to introduce Rabbi Dr. Moshe Sokolow.
Thank you very much. I appreciate both Rabbi Mintz and Rabbi Kelman's invitations and introductions. And I hope that I am up to a task that has bedeviled many of my predecessors in both the fields of Bible and Jewish education and Jewish thought. And that is to try to distill the wisdom of what has been called the most important and yet the most enigmatic book in the Bible in all of 60 minutes. I mentioned to my hosts previously that it is not my habit to speak without interruption. We kind of discourage that in the Israeli Graduate School of Jewish Education when we train teachers. We kind of put down frontal teaching. We encourage teachers to be not what's called the sage on the stage, but rather to be the guide on the side. So what I'm going to try to do is pause several times, maybe every quarter of an hour along the way. And if there is anything that's a rather pressing question, we'll have an opportunity to hear it then. Otherwise, if I do such a wonderful job that I raise no questions along the way, then you can just simply write your questions down in the chat box, and I will look at them at the end of the hour. Okay. So the question always is where to start. Do we start by talking about the book, or do we start by going right into the text itself? And that's always an interesting pedagogical question. Sometimes I like to do one, sometimes I like to do other, and on occasions like this, when I've got a large audience and I've got a screen sharing device, I like to do neither. So I'd like to do something that's neither the text itself, nor is it really about the text, but somehow it's connected to it, it's associated with the text, and I'll leave it for you over the next 3 minutes to try to figure out what the connection is. So bear with me for a moment as I share my screen with you.
And she wants a get. She wants a get.
Uh-huh. Sure.
I feel like the carpet's been yanked out from under me. I don't know which end is up. I'm not even sure how to react. I'm too confused.
What reasons did she give for the rupture?
She didn't give reasons, just that, you know, things haven't been going well.
And is that true?
I guess. I don't know. She's usually right about these things. I was hoping that Rabbi Nachner could...
That he would guess?
Well, with the benefit of his life experience. No offense.
No, of course not. I am the junior rabbi. And it's true, the point of view of somebody who's older and perhaps had similar problems might be more valid. And you should see the senior rabbi as well, by all means. Or even Marshak, if you can get in. He's quite busy, but maybe... Can I share something with you? Because I too have had the feeling of losing track of Hashem, which is the problem here. I too have forgotten how to see him in the world, and when that happens, you think, well, if I can't see him, he isn't there. He's gone. But the that's not the case. You just need to remember how to see him. Am I right? The parking lot here. Not much to see. But if you imagine yourself a visitor, somebody who isn't familiar with these autos and such, somebody still with the capacity for wonder, someone with a fresh perspective. That's what it is, Larry. Because with the right perspective, you can see Hashem, you know, reaching into the world. He is in the world, not just in Shul. It sounds to me like you're looking at the world, looking at your wife through tired eyes. It sounds like she's become a sort of thing, a problem, a thing.
She is seeing Cy Abelman.
Oh.
They're planning. That's why they want the get.
Oh, sorry.
It was his idea.
Well, they do need a get to remarry in the faith. But this is life. You have to see these things as expressions of God's will. You don't have to like it, of course.
The boss isn't always right, but he's always the boss.
That's
good. I think that's a good place in which to stop. This is a clip, as you probably saw in the bottom left-hand corner of the screen, from a 2009 movie by the Coen brothers called A Serious Man, in which this fellow who is being beset by all sorts of difficulties, marital, financial, and other, goes to seek the advice of three rabbis. And of course, the three different rabbis give him three different kinds of advice. And this is just one piece of it. This is from, obviously, the junior rabbi in the congregation. So the question really is whether this distills the wisdom of the book of Job, or whether, like many things in popular literature or on the screen, are really not so much distillations of deep thought as much as they are takeoffs on deep thought. But Job, to a certain extent, is indeed a man who is beset by a host of troubles, as we will see in just a moment when we get to the text, and who doesn't seek advice, but nevertheless, he is given advice. He's given advice by friends, he's given advice by, let's call them, colleagues, and eventually, as you know, if you've read the book, and if you've had the patience to get at least till chapter 38 of the book, he finally gets a response from none other than the boss himself. And in this case, of course, the boss has both the definite article, the, and the word boss capitalized, from God himself. Big difference, of course, is that this gentleman in the film was about to lose his wife, whereas Job does not lose his wife. And in fact, some wags over the last 2,000 years have commented that perhaps that was one of the worst afflictions that God set upon Job, that he took away his children and he took away his property and he took away his home and he was personally afflicted with boils, but he left his wife. And along the way, the wife gets into the act also by trying to be critical of her husband. When I teach the book of Job, or when I write about the book of Job, I like to begin with an anecdote. And the anecdote concerns a 19th century Eastern European Jewish sage who was known by the name of Rab Aizala Charif. Charif means spicy, and he was called spicy, both on account of the sharpness of his wit, as well as the acerbic nature of his speech. On one occasion, he was approached by an author and asked for a haskama, for an approbation, for a commentary that he'd written on the Bible. And Rabbi Zalacharif took it seriously, and he looked through the commentary, and he returned it to the author, and he said that he could write an approbation only for the commentary on the book of Job. And when the author asked him why only for the book of Job, Rabbi Zalacharif said, Job had so many tzaris that your book is not going to do him any greater harm. So the question, of course, always boils down to just how do we weigh the Tzaras of Job and how do we weigh the resolution of it. So I'd like to do really with no further ado, and if you have the source sheets, you're welcome to use them. Otherwise, I've got copies of them available here, is to go directly into the text of the book of Job and to see whether in 20 minutes we can actually do justice to 42 of what are really literarily and linguistically some of the most difficult chapters in biblical literature. Okay, I hope you can see this. All right. Okay. So, what I have here is really a synopsis of the book of Job with certain quotations, both in Hebrew and in English, highlighted as being somewhat representative of those different sections of the book. So we begin, of course, in chapter 1, verse 1, with the opening of the book, which tells us that there was a man in the land of Uz by the name of Eov, and that man, Eov, was tam, perfect, yashar, straight, yirei Elohim, God-fearing, v'sar merah, and never ever did anything wrong, right? Not even a parking ticket, okay? And this isn't just the attitude or the position of the author or the editor, because it's confirmed several verses later by God himself, who addresses a character named Satan, and we'll get to that in just a moment, asking him, Hasamta libecha al avdi Eov, have you noticed or have you paid attention to my servant Eov? Ki ein kamohu ba'aretz ishtam v'yashar yirei Elohim v'sar me'ra. For there is no one on earth who is his equal in terms of his piety, in terms of his sincerity, in terms of his being fearful of God, and in terms of his having committed no evil whatsoever. So it isn't just the author or the editor who wants us to know that Job was a perfectly righteous man. God himself, right, as it were, writes his own haskama, his own approbation for Job, confirming that Job indeed is, at least from God's perspective, blameless. And of course, this becomes the most important stipulation in the entire book. Satan replies to God saying, Hachinam yarei Eov Elohim? Is Job fearing God for naught? Ve'ulam, however, shlachna yadacha v'ga b'chol asher lo, all you might have to do, O Lord, is reach your hand out towards him, in essence, strike him. Imlo al panecha yivarecheka. I guarantee you, says Satan, that instantly, immediately, Eov will blaspheme. He will curse you. So what develops now is a wage, as it were, between God and the Satan, whether Job would indeed, as Satan anticipated, take these reverses in his personal fortune and curse God, or whether he would remain steadfast in his fear of God. And that continues now in the second chapter. In the first chapter, Eov suffers the loss of his children, the loss of his home, the loss of his fortune. But so far he has suffered no physical privations. So now God once again says to the Satan, have you noticed my servant Job? There is none like him on earth, blameless, upright, fears God, shuns evil. Odenu machazik bitumato. He still keeps his integrity. He has not cursed me. Therefore, says God, in chastising the Satan, Tisitenivo levalo chinam, you have incited me against him to swallow him up, to destroy him for no good reason. Okay? Meaning Job so far has withstood the test. Satan replies, saying, Or ba'ad or, v'chol asher la'ish yiten ba'ad nafsho. Skin for skin, as it were. If you imagine that a blow is coming towards you, you'll pick up your arm in order to ward it off. Okay? So it's your skin, as it were, against the skin of your attacker. So Satan says to God that somebody in defense of himself will put up an arm, right? Or ba'ad or, the chol asher la'ish, a person will give up anything. He will surrender his anything, ba'ad nafsho, in order to keep his life. Therefore, he essentially says, shlach na yadcha v'ga el atzmo v'el bisaro. Strike him physically, right? Strike his flesh and bone. Threaten his life, okay? Im lo al panecha yivaracheka, the same words that he used previously. I assure you, says Satan, that instantly, immediately, he is going to curse you. He will blaspheme. Who or what is Satan? In the introduction, in chapter 1, the Satan is described as a character whom God has noticed as he returned mishut ba'aretz umihit alechba, from flitting, as it were, in and out throughout the earth and from traversing it. And it's likely that the verb lashut, to, as it were, flit in and out, is related to the word Satan, the Hebrew letters Shin and Sin often being interchangeable, often sharing the same etymologies. It's possible that a Shatan or a Satan is so called on account of the fact that he professionally flits in and out. What do you call somebody who professionally flits in and out? Not so much an adversary, which is the translation here, nor even really an accuser, which is another translation. But perhaps the best definition of a Satan is a spy. That is to say, that what was the Satan doing on earth? What was he flitting in and out of? Clearly, he was spying on people and trying to take note of their weaknesses in order to take advantage of them. So I personally prefer to translate Satan as a spy, or perhaps as an accuser, rather than as an adversary. But for the purposes of this morning's discussion, adversary is certainly adequate for the task. And then, as I told you, in chapter 2, we had this. And then we have a tiny little selection. Okay, I'm up to the third paragraph, where his wife speaks to him, right? This is verses 9 and 10 in chapter 2, saying to him, Odcha machazik betumatacha? What's wrong with you? You're still upholding your integrity? Meaning you're willing to suffer even worse physical privations just so that you don't curse God? Barech Elohim. Let it go already. Blaspheme. Curse God. Amut. What's the worst that's going to happen? It can't be any worse than what you're already suffering through. And then Job gets his first opportunity to speak. We're in the fourth paragraph, which is from verses 9 and 10 in chapter 3. And Job says as follows, Lama lo merechem amot mi beten yatzati ve'egva. That if this is to be my fate, if I have to sit here penniless, homeless, and on top of all that, suffering from boils, then perhaps it might have been better if I had not been born at all. So he asks rhetorically, why did I not expire at birth? Why did I not die as I came forth from my mother's womb? Madua kidmuni verkayim, why did I develop? Why were there knees? That is to say, the knees of perhaps of the myaledet, of the woman who sat on the birth stool. Why were there knees to receive me or breasts for me to suck? For now, I would be lying in repose, asleep and at rest with the world's kings and counselors who rebuild ruins for themselves. In other words, Job is essentially not cursing God, but he is coming to the point where he's saying that the privations that he's suffering, sort of like, oh, I wish I didn't have to go through all of this. Now, if you say the only way that you could have avoided going through all of this is by not having been born at all, then okay, says Job, then maybe that's what we need to do. And at this point in time, beginning with chapter 4 and going all the way through chapter 37, we basically have exchanges between Job and four of his friends, three of whom come together as a company. And I cannot tell you, I have absolutely no idea whether this foreshadows the notion of the three wise men, the three magi, so to speak, whether this was borrowed from the book of Job or whether in fact it's a motif that is already present and common in ancient Near Eastern literature. But in any event, there are three friends who come together to address Job. And then there is a fourth member, let's say, of the company who shows up independently afterwards. So first we hear from the first of the three friends, Eliphaz. And essentially what the three friends of Job are trying to persuade him is that, as you see here in the opening words of Eliphaz, Zechorna, think for a moment. Mi hu naki avad? Has an innocent man ever perished? Meaning, if you're committed to the notion of God's justice, a notion which in fancy terms is called theodicy, the question of God's justice, if you are committed to the principle that God is just, then you have to assume that suffering is punishment. And if God does not cause innocent people to suffer, then ipso facto, anyone who is suffering cannot be innocent. Therefore, essentially what the friends are saying to Job in as many different ways as they choose to address him is that, face it, Job, if you lost your children and you lost your fortune and you lost your home and you're sitting here suffering with boils, then it's clear that you are not naki, you are not innocent. You've obviously done something wrong. The problem, of course, is that Job read the opening of the book that bears his name. And he knows that it isn't just the opinion of an author or an editor that he is a perfectly righteous man. It isn't even his own self-estimation. Job knows that in the eyes of God, he is a tam v'yashar v'yirei Elohim v'sar meira. And therefore, all of these different expressions on the part of Job's friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, to the effect that if Job is suffering, he must have committed some crime, Job finds all of these unacceptable. Bildad, for example, and the selection here is from chapter 8, Ha'el Ya'avet Mishpat, can God pervert justice? Im Shaddai Ya'avet Tzedek? Of course God does not pervert what is right and what is just. Therefore, whatever is necessarily just and right, even if we can't see the justice or the rightness of it. Zophar says, Halo yada'ata mini ad, that you've known from time immemorial, mini sim adam ale aretz, from the beginning of history, ki rinenat rishaim mikarov, v'simchat chaneif ade raga, that only people, that the people whose joy has been curtailed, has been cut short, are by definition wicked and impious. And so it is with Elihu, the selection here from chapter 32, who comes to offer a slightly different approach. From his name, there's the suggestion that he's supposed to represent a Jewish character. If you think about it, the name Eov, the proper noun Eov, is not distinctly Jewish. Okay, if anything, it looks kind of like the word Oyev, right? Which isn't really a name that you would expect any Jewish mother to bestow upon her son, but it certainly doesn't resonate with anything positive, Jewishly or Hebraically. And if we take the names of his friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar, they don't strike us as being particularly Jewish names either. Yes, Eliphaz does have what we call a theophoric substantive. It does have the word ale in it, but remember that ale is just simply a typical name for a Semitic deity. It isn't particularly Jewish, okay? When we get to Elihu, however, he's called Elihu ben Barachel Habuzi. So his name contains the same theophoric substantive. Elihu literally means, this is my God. Okay. Barachel means one who has blessed God or been blessed by God. Okay. And Buzi is particularly interesting because it seems to be an epithet that is recognizable in biblical literature. It is applied also to the prophet Ezekiel. Ezekiel, Yechezkel, one of his ancestors' names is Buzi. And there is a connection between the book of Job and the book of Ezekiel. And I'll pause at this moment to see whether there are any outstanding questions and to interrupt our narrative with the connection to Ezekiel.
They can look at the chat box. The questions are there in the chat box. Yeah, okay.
I am doing. I'm trying to start at the top. So etymology of the name of Eov, as I said, I just suggested the closest you can come to it in Hebrew is Oyev. Who else but Job's wife could appreciate the depths of what he lost, the depths of his loss, just looking in each other's eyes? Absolutely. As I said, the question is beguiled and bedeviled. Commentators and philosophers since the book of Job first was published, and that is why Job's wife, first of all, why she survives. If his children are taken, why not his wife? And secondly, why she doesn't play a bigger role in the story. Sar Mira seems to be a play on the Pasuk from Tehillim, Sar Mira Vaseh Tov. Yeah, not sure which plays on what. That really depends upon where you place the authorship of the book of Job, which we'll get to, I promise you, after we finish our survey of the text itself. His wife has no empathy. In essence, she tells him to curse God and die. As I said again, she is definitely one of the more interesting characters in the book. What does this say about God being capricious and sadistic to a man for a bet with Satan? Clearly, it's not for the purpose of the bet with Satan. It's clearly for the purpose of everybody like us who read the story of Job. Only if you believe that God is a micromanager. Book is about God's role in what happens to us. Yes, what we believe about that may be the question. The book wants us to take this perspective. We'll get it. We don't know yet exactly what the perspective is. As I said, up until now, what we've only had is what philosophers call conventional theology. The conventional theology is that the good prosper, the wicked suffer. Therefore, anybody who is prospering must be righteous. Anybody who is suffering must be wicked. Okay. Elihu cognate with Eliyahu, as I said, it basically means this is my God. I don't know if Harman Wolk was a particular fan of the book of Job, but if he had said that to somebody at one point in his life that he chose the title, this is my God because of Elihu, I would certainly believe it. Okay. I said that there is a connection between the book of Job and the prophet Ezekiel. One of the texts that was circulated is called, they're outtakes from my book. It's an outtake from my book, Tanakh and Owner's Manual. And since you all have it, and I'm not going to read it through in detail, I'm just going to make reference to it. I'm not going to put it up on the screen. I'll just share with you my thought on the subject. The only other reference to Eov in the Tanakh is in the book of Yechezkel. In Yechezkel chapter 14, verses 13 to 14, we find the following passage. Ben Adam, son of man, that's the invariable way in which God addresses the prophet Ezekiel. Eretz ki techeta li lim'ol ma'al. If there is a country that should sin against me or trespass against me, v'natiti yadi aleha, I will reach my arm out towards that nation, obviously in anticipation of punishing it, v'shavarti la mate lachem, and I will cause I will break the staff of bread, which means, and you don't have to guess because it's in the next phrase, v'hishlachti ba'ra'av, that I will cause a famine in that land, v'hichrati mimena adamu v'hema, and both mankind and animals will die as a result of the famine. Okay. A famine, remember, that was brought about because the people of that land, the people of that country, are sinful. All right? Then the next verse says, V'hayu shloshet ha'anashim ha'ela bitocha. Even if these three men were residents of that country, of that land, and who are those three men? Noach, Daniel, V'iyahuv. Right? If Noah, Daniel, and Job were residents of that land, the land that sinned and was about to be punished, Hema b'tzidkatam yinatzelu nafsham, they, on account of their righteousness, may be able to save their own lives. Okay? But the implication is that their righteousness, their merit, would not extend to others. For example, Noah was a righteous man. We have no clue as to whether Sam, right, Ham, and Japhet were righteous, but they were saved on account of Noah's merit. Okay? So this is the only other reference in the Bible to Eov. And he is cast here in the company of Noah and in the company of, apparently, Daniel, as somebody who is recognized as being implicitly righteous. There is, however, a little more to this reference than meets the eye. First of all, to whom was this prophecy of Ezekiel addressed? Chapter 14 of the book of Ezekiel was addressed to the Negid Tzor, to the nobleman, to the ruler of the city, or actually the city-state of Tyre in Phoenicia. Now, it's curious. If the prophet Ezekiel is not, in this verse, not addressing a Jewish audience, not an Israelite audience, he's reciting a prophecy to the people, to the Phoenicians who live in the city of Tyre, then if he mentions Noah and Daniel and Job, it would seem to reason that these are not characters from Israelite biblical literature who are well known perhaps to Israelites, but might not have been known at all to Phoenicians. It seems likely, and maybe even likelier, that these three characters are non-Jewish characters, characters who were chosen from the ancient world, from the folklore of the ancient world, and whose reputations preceded them beyond the Bible. Now, flood stories are a dime a dozen in the ancient Near East. The inhabitants of Mesopotamia, whether they were Sumerians or whether they were Akkadians or whether they were Assyrians or whether they were Babylonians, all had a flood story. The Canaanites all had flood stories, whether they were Canaanites, whether they were Ugarites, whether they were Tyrians. Okay. Therefore, the presence of a character named Noah who survived a flood is certainly an appeal to a pan-Semitic motif. Eov, as possibly again, a non-Jewish, righteous character of antiquity, makes the same appeal. The sticking point here, the sore thumb, so to speak, would be Daniel. Not only because why would anybody in Phoenicia have heard of Daniel who lived in Babylonia, but because it's difficult to say with any certitude that the prophet Ezekiel knew of Daniel, since Daniel and Ezekiel were contemporaries. And if Ezekiel was the older contemporary, then it's difficult even to imagine how the prophet Ezekiel could even have known about the biblical Daniel, let alone, of course, the fact that the biblical Daniel doesn't fit in the company of Noah and Job, because while he's a prophet and he's very wise and he interprets dreams, there's no evidence in the biblical text, at least, that he was particularly righteous. Therefore, the suggestion of modern scholarship is that this isn't the biblical Daniel. This is the Canaanite, the Ugaritic Daniel, a figure well known from Ugaritic Canaanite literature who had the reputation, Kishmo Kenhu, of being a righteous judge, Daniel, of being a righteous judge and therefore a righteous man. Therefore, in the company of Noah and Eov, Daniel forms a perfect little a triumvirate here of three characters out of antiquity, non-Jewish characters who nevertheless had the reputations of being particularly righteous men. My own theory, as I develop here in the selection that you have in my book, is that since the prophet Ezekiel is the only other person to make reference to Job, and he throws into the book of Job a character named Elihu ben Barach el Habuzi, which means that he shares an ancestry with Ezekiel, why not try out the suggestion that Ezekiel was the author of the book of Job? And that what I refer to is that the book of Job is the equivalent of Ezekiel's, just to use, to borrow a term from the literature, Holocaust theology. That is to say, the prophet Ezekiel was an eyewitness to the destruction of the temple, to the destruction of the city of Jerusalem, to the killings of the defenders of Jerusalem, to their going into captivity. Why should the prophet Ezekiel not have written something speculating on whether the destruction of the temple and Jerusalem were punishment for the sins of the Jewish people or not? And therefore, I have this suspicion that the book of Job, that Sefer Eov, might indeed have been written by Yechezkel, in which he used the different characters, the friends of Eov, as a way of trying out the conventional explanation for suffering, namely sin, rejecting it, and replacing it ultimately with the point at which we have arrived in the story of the book of Job, and that is with God's revelation of himself to Job, in order to make the point and to give Job a reassurance that there is a divine plan for history as there is a divine plan for nature, and that our inability to perceive God's plan for history is in no way different from our inability very often, and as we actually find ourselves now and have been for the last several months, unable to comprehend God's plan for nature. And with that, we can come back to the screen and simply look quickly at what God had to say to Eov. First of all, it seems to be significant, I got the right text, that God addresses Eov from a se'ara. Se'ara here is translated as tempest. Other English translations have it as a whirlwind. If you are familiar with Holocaust literature, you may know that in an early anthology of Holocaust literature was entitled by its editor, Out of the Whirlwind. And that clearly was meant to echo this verse at the beginning of chapter 38 in the book of Job, where God addresses Eov out of a tempest or out of a whirlwind. And basically he says to Eov, you want to know why you're suffering? Efo hayita biyasadi aretz hagedim yadarata vina. Were you around when I laid the foundations of the earth? Can you even explain creation to me? And what basically happens now and takes place over the next several chapters is where God regales Job with different aspects of creation, with the creation of heaven and earth, with the creation of the sea, with the creation of the luminaries, with the creation of man, and with the creation of animals and fish and birds. Two characters in particular are well known and highly regarded and written of in the literature, in the paragraph here that I am clicking on, in which I've highlighted. Of course, if we're going to highlight a word, I'm going to highlight the Lord. We see that that God draws Eov's attention to two animals, two creatures in particular, right? He says to him, take now behemot. Right? If you ever wondered about the origin of that odd English word, behemoth, right? Something that's gargantuan, something that's titanic, right? Here it is, okay? Take now behemoth, whom I have made as I did you. Meaning, you know, you're one person, but everybody is God's creature, and so are animals. And as much as we would want to understand everything about ourselves, we're really not entitled, as it were, to a deeper understanding of ourselves than we are entitled to an understanding of other people or of other creatures. And following it later in the same chapter, Timshoch Livyatan Bechaka, can you draw out Leviathan with a fish hook? Leviathan seems to be a sea creature. And there's a rich literature, literature that goes back, in fact, over 1,000 years in speculation as to whether the behemoth and the Leviathan are real animals or whether they are mythological creatures. I do believe that I sent out in the source sheets some of the sources for this. I entitled it Behemoth and Leviathan Zoology or Mythology. These are the respective verses. We've looked at them already. If they are zoological, then the consensus is that the behemoth is the hippopotamus and that the Leviathan is a crocodile. Okay. Parenthetically, I just love the word hippopotamus. Hippos is Greek for a horse. Potamos is Greek for a river. And the hippopotamus is a river horse. Okay. If you think of Mesopotamia, right? Meso means in between, and potamos are rivers, right? That's how you get between the rivers. Okay? If you think about it also, it means that Potomac River is redundant. Okay, kind of like the Sahara Desert, because Sahara is Arabic for desert. Or if you want a biblical example, it's like Hor Hahar, right? Mount Har. Okay, so if the Behemoth and the Leviathan are indeed zoological, then they are the hippopotamus and the crocodile. And God is calling Eob's attention to the fact that here are two creatures. They're not simple creatures, right? The hippopotamus is large. Why does it have that short snout? Why does it have that short curly tail? Why is it built like a tank, right? It's like an elephant with a short nose, but short ears. You know, why the crocodile? Why the scales? Okay. However, there's another school of thought that argues that these are not actual animals, but that these are mythological creatures. Back in the mythology of the ancient Near East, and again, both the mythology of Mesopotamia and the mythology of the land of Canaan, the creation of the world by the victorious gods is invariably preceded by a cosmic battle in which the losers, the bad gods, are always served by monsters, primordial monsters. So the hippopotamus and the crocodile are one side. The alternative is that these are monsters, fictitious characters, right? Monsters that were defeated during the cosmic battle that preceded creation. And the interesting thing is that there's very strong argument to be made for the mythological identification in Jewish tradition. There's a verse in the book of Psalms that I've cited here, talking about the great sea, Sham, there in the sea, Oniyot Yahalechon, ships go there, Livyatan Ze, Leviathan, a sea creature, Yatzarta, whom God created, Lisachekbo, to toy with it, to sport with it. Now, of course, semantically, that's wrong, because Bo, the antecedent of Bo, is not the Livyatan. The antecedent of Bo is the antecedent of Sham, namely the sea, right? It's there in the sea, two things happen, right? Boats go through the sea, and the Leviathan plays in the sea. So the really, according to the Pshat, the most you can make out of this verse is that Leviathan is a creature, a sea creature that may appear to be playful, okay? But Jewish tradition took it otherwise. As it took the verse in the continuation of our own book of Job in chapter 40, verse 31. The Masoretic reading is Hatmale bisukot oro. Can you fill his hide with sukot? Uvitzilzal dagim rosho, or will you fill his head with spears? Now, since we know that a almost invariable characteristic of biblical poetry is synonymous parallelism, then the Sukkot must be parallel to the Tzilzal, in which case Sukkot here are not what the tradition takes it to mean, namely those booths that we sit in for 8 days in the fall, leading to the supposition that in the world to come, God will have a banquet for the righteous, and the banquet will be served in a tent, a sukkah that is made out of orosh ha-livyatan, out of the hide of the Leviathan, the sea creature. But really, Sukkot here is probably more an alternative form of the word sikim. Sikim are either thorns, or in modern Hebrew, sikim are pins, darts, if you will. Okay. In any event, what tradition squeezed out of all of this is the identification of the Leviathan as a sea creature whose flesh God will serve to the righteous at the banquet that is reserved for them in the world to come, right? It'll be, as it were, the vorspeis, right? The entree preceding the main dish, which will be the shor habar. And of course, anybody who's ever made reference to this is not allowed to miss the opportunity to raise the famous rhetorical question: if God can feed the righteous with steaks, with the shor habar, why in the world does he need to serve them fish? Why does he need the Leviathan? And the answer is, of course, that even at the banquet that God will throw for the righteous in the world to come, there will be those who won't necessarily accept the shechita. Okay, that's, as I said, that comes with the territory. Okay. Those of you who are interested, Robert Gordis, in his commentary on the book of Job, gives his arguments for why he believes that the creatures mentioned in the book of Job are not the mythological creatures, but really are the zoological creatures. And that essentially what God is saying is that here you have two fearsome creatures, the hippopotamus and the crocodile. If you only saw their pictures in an album, you would think that these are man-eating creatures and you would be fearful of them. And yet the description of these creatures that we just read in the book of Job is that they eat grass. They're herbivorous, not carnivorous. And therefore the same that appearances may be deceiving in the world of nature, so are appearances deceiving in the moral world. And here's where we have to say a couple of words, officially and formally, about theodicy. And that's another one of the source sheets that you have. I just simply have to get it here on the screen for you. Okay. The Mishnah in Avot already tells us that biyadenu, in our hands, that is to say, within our capacity for understanding, right, there is neither shalvat harishaim nor yisurei hatzadikim. In other words, the Mishnah in Avot tells us that we are unable, or we should consider ourselves to be unable, to understand either why the wicked are prospering or why the righteous are suffering. This, as I said, is the question of theodicy. The definition in the OED, Oxford English Dictionary, is the Orean vindication of the divine attributes, particularly the attributes of justice and holiness, in respect to the existence of evil. A writing, doctrine, or theory intended, quote, to justify the ways of God to men. If you take a look here at David Hume's discussion of theodicy, Epicurus's old questions are yet unanswered. Is God willing to prevent evil but not able? Then he's impotent. If he is able to prevent evil but not willing, then he's malevolent. If he's both able and willing but ignorant of evil's existence, then he's not omniscient. Therefore, Hume's question was, how do you explain the existence of evil if God is supposed to be all three of these things? God is supposed to be omniscient, omnipotent, and benevolent. Moshe Greenberg, who wrote actually a small commentary on the book of Job as in the JPS series, wrote, the terrible paradox is that no righteous man can measure his love of God unless he suffers a fate befitting the wicked. And that, of course, is the quintessence of the book of Job. Philosophers talk about two types of evil. They talk about moral evil, and they talk about natural evil. Moral evil is the type of evil that we confronted in the Holocaust, that we confronted at the time of Haman, which is why I added several comments here at the end by Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, who was not writing about theodicy at all, but he was writing about evil. It's an essay of his in my book called Reading the Rav. It's called Purim, a Time for Spiritual Sobriety. Okay. The Rav himself called it a metaphysical view of the holiday of Purim. And he adduced four important lessons that have to do with evil, particularly moral evil. One is that from time to time, human beings replace their personalities, in which the image of God is implanted, with a satanic personality in which evil prevails. Two, Amalek is the symbol of evil, the enemy of mankind in general, but first, foremost, and especially, Amalek attacks Jews. 3, the hatred of Jews is not aimed at religious Jews alone or even specifically. It's aimed at everyone who is known by the name Jew, even if it only goes back one generation, or if you wish, even if it has skipped generations. And finally, whenever the modern Satan Amalek struggles with the diffuse and scattered nation, Am Mifuzar Umufurad Bein Ha'amim, there will surely arise a factor that will protect that nation, oppose Amalek with full force, and overcome him. It's just that as often, or maybe even more often than we are called upon individually, communally, nationally, or even universally to confront moral evil, we're called upon to confront natural evil. Natural evil is the evil of a famine, the evil of a forest fire, the evil of an avalanche, the evil of an earthquake, the evil of a coronavirus. And the same questions that are addressed to the justice of God when the subject is moral evil are addressed to God when the subject is natural evil. The difference, of course, is that it's difficult in cases of natural evil to say that the wicked are prospering. Somehow the rich do better, but not necessarily the wicked. The consensus of moral philosophers in addressing the subject of natural evil is that natural evil exists in order to give us an opportunity to practice our reactions. Is, if you wish, a test. There is a school of philosophy, and indeed one that includes commentators on the book of Job, a test. And it introduces the concept of yisurim, of privations, but yisurim shel ahava, privations that are provoked not by hatred, not by enmity, but that are provoked by love. That is to say, the conventional form says, nobody's perfect. There are no perfect righteous people. And if you wish, there are no irredeemable wicked people. Therefore, there's a school of thought that says as follows. In order to ensure that the righteous in the world to come will be rewarded for all of their good and will not be debited for anything that they did wrong, God punishes them, as it were, or causes them to suffer in this life so that, first of all, the suffering is not fatal, right? And secondly, so that in the world to come, they will receive a pure reward because they will have already paid for their demerits, so to speak. And conversely, when you see the wicked prospering, it's because he's done something good, but God doesn't want to be beholden to him in the world to come. And therefore, to make sure that in the world to come, he has no call on God for any merit that he might have accumulated, God acquits him of his merit in this world so that in the world to come, he goes straight to hell. How can we know how to judge people? Not so much to judge people, we can't judge them. But how do we know, how do we prepare ourselves for viewing moral evil, say the philosophers? That's why there are famines, that's why there are earthquakes, that's why there are forest fires, That's why there are avalanches. And I'm sure that over the last 6 months, there has been a spate of literature suggesting that that too is why, from time to time, there are pandemics. I have one last little story, as I see that the hour is approaching noon, and I want to leave you time for whatever questions may have accumulated. And that is that I must read you the end of the book of Job. Why must I read you the end of the book of Job? For two reasons. The only reason that really matters is because there is an end to the book of Job. There was an end to Job's suffering. And it's not only interesting to know, but it's important to know that at the end it says in chapter 42, beginning with verse 10, Vashem shav et shivut Iyov, that God restored Job. When Job not only pleaded his own case, but pleaded on behalf of his fellows. Vayosef Hashem et kol asher li'Iyov lemishneh. And God added to Job, doubled everything that he had, so that if Job had had seven sons and seven daughters, he now had 14 of each. And if Job had so many sheep and so many cattle, he now had twice the number. And it tells us not only that, that Job's daughters, Vashem Berachet Acharit Iyov Mereshito, God saw to it that Job at the end was blessed even more than he had been previously. As I said, he originally had 7,000 sheep, now he had 14,000 sheep, and he had so many thousand camels and so many thousand pairs of oxen and so many donkeys, and he had Shiva Anavanim, 2 times 7 sons, Vishalosh Banot. We didn't know that Job originally had daughters, but now we find that Job also had 3 daughters. And we are told further that Job's daughters were the most beautiful in the land. And their names were Yemima, Kitzia, and Keren Hapoch. You've ever wondered where Aunt Jemima came from? Jemima was the name of one of Job's daughters. And it evidently came from an evangelical Christian, probably a black slave in the Deep South. But I tell you about the end of the book of Job for another reason. When I started teaching Bible in Yeshiva College, I saw that I started talking to some older colleagues about what their experiences had been. And I heard the following story. I heard a story about a recent Yeshiva College graduate who had been the first graduate of the college ever to be a finalist for a very prestigious graduate fellowship. And when he went to be interviewed for the fellowship, I'm interpolating a little here on my own, I imagine that since he was the first Yeshiva College student they had ever interviewed, they thought that they would open by throwing him a softball. So they looked at his transcript and they saw that he had just taken a course in the book of Job and gotten an A. So they thought that they would start the interview by asking him something about the book of Job. And you know what they asked him? They asked him, tell me, what do you think of the ending? Whereupon it transpired that the only person who had ever taught Job in the history of Yeshiva College would start on the first day with Perek Aleph, Pasuk Aleph, do every Rashi, every Ibn Ezra, every Ralbag. In a good year, he would reach chapter 2, but he often never even finished chapter 1. Now, the panel didn't hold the student responsible for the faults and failures of his teacher, but they must have thought that it was strange that here was an Orthodox young man who had so little curiosity about his own intellectual heritage that he never thought that it was worthwhile to read to the end of the book on his own. And I've always taken that to heart and always made sure that I made my students read the end of the book of Job and actually read the end of any biblical book that they're reading. So please don't disappoint me and make sure that you too read the end of the book of Job. And with that, I thank you, first of all, for what questions we have had up until now. And let me see if I can find where we left off so that I can pick up on the, okay. Yeah, okay, so possible that Yov was a well-known character in the ancient world. I think that I covered that. Remind me of the chapter and verse in Ezekiel that you read. I was trying to do that all along. Okay, Somebody else pointed out that the site of the ancient city of Ugarit is in southern Syria. And today on a map, you won't find Ugarit unless you're looking at a biblical map, but you will find a place called Ras Shamra. There should be an R there. It's Ras Shamra. Isn't the biblical Daniel known for praying multiple times? Yes, praying facing Jerusalem. Yes, and I said in interpreting dreams, but not per se being righteous. The meaning of the word Eov suggests that Eov is a compound for Ayei Av. Very nice. That's very good. That's very darshanic, very, very homiletical. Okay. Movie reference, yes. Well, the question, where's the land of Oz, right? The land of Oz, the land of Utz. We didn't really get into, there's a source sheet on the, which simply are citations from the Talmud on trying to situate the character of Job or the author of the book of Job somewhere in biblical Jewish history. Of course, an opportunity to point out that the most interesting and perhaps most significant opinion raised in the Talmud is not the one that tries to pin Eov to the map or to the timeline, but basically says Eov lo haya v'lo nivra ela mashal haya, that there never was an historical character named Eov, but rather the entire story of Eov is a parable, which of course fits very well with my theory that it is the prophet Ezekiel's Holocaust theology. In which case I will even borrow from those professors, and I'll make sure to credit them if I ever put it into print, and say that he chose the name of Eov as the character for the book because everybody was walking around those days saying, Ayei Av, where is our Father in heaven? So I thank you all for those observations. Is there a connection between Eliyahu being taken away by a whirlwind and this whirlwind? Eliyahu did go up to heaven in a fiery chariot in a se'arah, but there are other references to God being in a se'arah. Psalm 68, for example, is just chock full of references to God being borne aloft on clouds and swept away in the wind, so it wouldn't necessarily have to come from there. Section of Yom similar to Rabbi Kushner. Yes, of course. I mean, Harold Kushner and When Bad Things Happen to Good People is very much influenced by the book of by Jewish philosophy. It's also very much influenced by the book, by the end of the book of Job, which is that if I recall correctly, Kushner does subscribe to the notion that says that if you believe in God and you believe that there is a divine plan, then you simply have to believe that what's happening to you and happening to others is part of that plan. Even if you are unable at this moment, or even in retrospect, you're unable to discern what the plan was, if you believe in God, then you believe that there is a plan. Natural evil built into the system by God, but could God not have found different ways to test us? Yes, seemingly less capricious, affecting less people. You know, I meant to read something, and maybe I will read it. As it takes but a minute. I want to show you this. I don't know whether you can see it because of my screen. So I'm going to kill my background so that you can see what I'm holding up. I have a nice little library of commentaries on Job. Can you see this one?
We can see it, yeah.
Okay, yeah, thank you. So you see it's called The First Dissident, the Book of Job, right, in Today's Politics by William Safire, right? William Safire essentially writes, Job reaches across the millennia to express modern man's outrage at today's inequities. The book of Job's tone is not a weary resignation to life's unfairness. Rather, it is a sustained note of defiance. The book's message is not that we should accept the dictates of fate, but rather that we should object to authority's injustice or unconcern, and assert our morality as best we can. So I think that there's a lesson there. What else have we got here in terms of question? I think that's a very interesting and different perspective to take. Is this ending really the original ending or a Disney ending? If there are people who will take a scalpel to the Torah and divvy it up amongst sources, then rest assured, and Isaiah, right? Rest assured that there are theories about Job 1, Job 2, and that the author of the introduction and the author of the postscript are different from the author of the body of the book. So there are a lot of speculation on the authorship. Okay, you're welcome. Sources. I sent out the source sheets. I assume if you contact Rabbi Kelman, there's a way.
It's on our website already. The source sheet's always posted on our website. Yeah.
Again, we want more. I thank you very much. I teach lots of courses, but you wouldn't want to have to pay the tuition. but maybe we can do something else through Torah.
Our emotions nice and free for people. That's it.
We may be able to. I've been giving a parsha class at Lincoln Square Synagogue for 35 years, but obviously for the last 6 months it's been online, but I'm afraid that that's somewhat limited in its distribution. But as I said, maybe you can work something out with Rabbi Kelman. I think I've gotten through pretty much everything. Yes. Rabbi Kelman, if there is something, turn back to you or to Rabbi Mintz for a closing remark.
The only thing I'm curious to follow up on, you sort of, the question on the doubling of the Neil and righteousness, I just maybe want to delve for half a minute. Basically, you distinguish the fact that he davened three times a day facing Yerushalayim has no bearing on whether he was righteous. Maybe you want to expand on that, because the question was, of course, if he's davening three times a day, then, obviously he's righteous. So perhaps you want to.
So the question, my definition of righteousness is that it's a description of character, not of comportment.
Okay.
I see righteousness as being someone who would, sooner or later we're going to get to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. So I can tell you that my congregants, we meet only once a year, and that's for the High Holy Days. That's the only time during the whole year that I pretend to be a rabbi.
So you can't speak for an hour. You can't.
I don't. Even then, I give out source sheets. I give out source sheets, and we read them together. So they know that one of my favorites is that if you wish, the centerpiece of the liturgy on both Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippurim is the Piyut of Netan HaTokef. And the focal point of the Piyut of Netan HaTokef are the words Tshuva Tfilah Utzdaka Ma'avirin et Roah HaGzeirah. And as I tell everybody who will listen to me, Tshuva is not repentance, Tfilah is not prayer, and Tzedaka is not charity. Those are just simply three awful translations. Repentance happens to come from the same etymology as the word penitentiary. It means punishment. Okay, repentance means to suffer for a crime. Prayer literally means to ask for, and while bakasha, to beseech, is a dimension of tefillah, it's not synonymous with the entire enterprise. The shorish of tefillah is pelamid lamid, which means to judge, and lahit palel means to stand in self-judgment, to be introspective. Charity comes from the Latin root caritas, which means love. And it's a Christian concept that I have to give. If I have and you don't, then out of my love for a fellow human being, I should give you something so that you have something too. In Hebrew, the word is tzedakah, which means that is just. Meaning the fact that I have more than I need and you have less than you need isn't just a social inequity, it's a crime. And the only way to redress it, the only way to make tzedek out of it, is for me to give you something that I don't need to make up for what you don't have but need. So to me, that's what tzedakah is, that's what righteousness is. It doesn't mean putting on Rashi tefillin and Rabbeinu Tam tefillin. It doesn't mean wearing your tzitzis out. It doesn't mean, shuckling when you daven. Those are important things too. But they are not more important than the character traits as well.